Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, you know, a founder where we're going to be learning a lot about the building, scaling, financing. I mean, all of that good stuff that we like to hear, you know, on this show. And again, you know, brace yourself for a very incredible, you know, inspiring, you know, episode that we have ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Michael Friedrich. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro. Nice to be here.
So originally born in Bern in Switzerland. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Pretty happy childhood. Grew up in the suburbs of Bern. Was not growing up in an entrepreneurial environment. My dad worked as a dentist. Went to school back in Bern and got in touch with entrepreneurship very early on. It was in the mid-90s when the internet was born and when we started to program. And I started the first company in 96, which was when we were 15 years old, and was the first time that I got hooked onto this profession, passion that entrepreneurship is about.
And 21 years old, I mean, that's very young. I mean, at that point, you know, the company was basically a way to help in financing school. Is that right?
We did it because it was intellectually stimulating. Building a company is always an incredible challenge on all dimensions, and we just had fun doing it. And at the time, there was no risk because we still were getting home in the evening, getting dinner from mom, having a bed, and nothing to worry about. So no downside, and it was just pure upside and exploration.
That's amazing. Eventually, you ended up going to Lausanne and studying engineering. So what prompted that? Because, I mean, here you are getting the best taste of, you know, the entrepreneurial world and in business. So why going back to studying?
Well, we knew that this one was not the company that we wanted to build our lives on. It was a very good gig for us to get experience in entrepreneurship, to earn some money, to have fun. But we always knew that this was the time then at 20 or 21 to learn something, to get a real job, to learn something, a true profession. And that is what we did. And then hence we sold the company, which financed our studies. And I went then to Lausanne while my co-founders, they went to Zurich.
Did that give you any type of exposure or visibility into that full cycle of an entrepreneur, of what it looks like, you know, to reach the finish line and perhaps some more self-confidence for the next time around?
It absolutely did. And I truthfully, had I not had this opportunity during studies, during high school, I would probably never have dared to build my own company after graduation, after my master's. And so it really was a very, very important moment in my life, because I learned to trust myself on those topics. I learned to trust my skills, my intuition. And that really was for me the enabler to then start something after school. Or after university.
So when you went to university, you met a professor there that introduced you to the whole idea of intellectual property. That kind of like changed the course of everything. How so?
Very true. After my studies, or actually during my studies, I was leading a student team of about 30 students in which we designed a solar-powered race car. We wanted to participate in a solar car race in Australia, but ultimately didn't manage to raise the funds. And that was a bit of a downer, a failure. And then I was a little bit depressed at the end of my studies. Worked for this professor in his lab. He graciously accepted me as an engineer. And when I then wanted to leave his lab, he said, "Well, Michael, I have these patents on this blood flow imaging technology. Wouldn't you want to build a company with me?" And that's then when I thought, "Oh, what a savior! What a great opportunity!" Called back Mark, with whom I worked already in my previous company, and we then together decided with the professor to start iMogo, the first medical device company that I built.
So there was one thing that happened there, which was, you know, another acquisition, no? But obviously the outcome was great. You know, it was a good outcome, right? I mean, you guys sold the company for how much?
12.5 million at the time, which was not that big, but still it allowed every investor to earn money. which was very important because these investors, these early investors, without them, nothing ever happens and no company gets incorporated. And it's super important that the early investors, they make money. And fortunately, they were so happy with what we did, not necessarily from a financial return perspective, but more from how they saw us handling issues, solving problems, and showing perseverance, that when I then joined Digital Motion as a lead investor of a Series B financing round, most of these prior investors, they then decided to chip in again and are now part of this incredible story that we are writing with Digital Motion.
And we'll talk about that in just a little bit, because obviously, you know, like here with the company, with Imago, you know, which was the one that you guys sold for over 12 million. Essentially, when the transaction happened and you ended up working, you know, for the acquirer, the picture was not the picture that you had thought, you know, that you were entering. You know, what happened there, and what were the sequences of events?
The exit, the transaction, was a rather unconventional one. When we developed our blood flow imaging camera at the time, we started the company in 2008 and we sold it in 2014, just to frame it in time. In 2011, we realized that our product was technically very neat from an engineering perspective, a marvel, but clinically not sufficiently compelling and hence not generating the sales that we would have needed to make this company a success. So we were very much stuck in a very challenging situation where we had, from an engineering perspective, something great, but commercially something that was not really gonna succeed. And this led to a lot of sleepless nights, because obviously we already had money spent and were very worried. And then, fortunately, we discovered a competitor of ours who had a similar technology, not the same as ours. Their technology required the injection of a contrast agent into the bloodstream. Our camera didn't require any injection. And this competitor at the time was already listed at NASDAQ, an enormous market capitalization for very little revenue and huge losses. And what we essentially saw is that their multiple revenue to market cap so high that it was only justified by the market believing that what they had was really unique. And so we then realized that our only way of getting out would be to go to the investors of our competitor, to the key opinion leaders of our competitor, to the research analysts of the banks covering our competitor, and essentially explain them that we have the next generation technology, which is cheaper, doesn't require an injection, and could essentially do the same. And we all did that with the aim of educating the market and ultimately potentially creating pressure on the share price of our competitor. And that is ultimately what happened. And that then forced our competitors to make us an offer to buy us out. And so that is a very aggressive, obviously, approach that we game that we played as the David, the small entity against the Goliath, but it worked out. But then it was also very clear that when I joined the acquirer as an employee, as part of the transition, that this was not going to be a long-term relationship, that I just had to hand over what they acquired, and then I ultimately left. And so that's when, even before we signed the final agreements on the trade sale, I already started to look out for what I was going to do next. And I met the founder team actually 2 months before the closing of the exit of Imago.
So talking about that too, I mean, it sounds like you were already getting involved with investing in startups, right? Because, I mean, you were one of the investors of Digital Motion, and that's how, you know, everything, you know, led to where you are today. So how did you get involved with investing in startups as well?
So I only invested in Digital Motion. I really just wanted to prove to myself that I could do a bigger gig than Imago was and build a product that was going to be commercially successful. And so when I saw Digital Motion, the early technology, the early idea, I understood that this was going to fly. It was an existing market, very strongly growing market, surgical robotics, with very clearly identified pain points around cost and complexity of existing robotic solutions. And I knew that what we had in hand at the time already was addressing these issues and was ultimately solving the access issue that robotics has in going from the prime hospitals, high complex procedures into medium to lower complexity procedures, into outpatient sites of care, and also into geographies that today do not really have that much access to robotics. And so the market was clear, that the momentum, the trends of the market were very good, and I know the pain points were very well understood, and I knew that we had the recipe to overcome those pain points that the current solutions in the market have. And that's why I then decided, okay, let's go all in. I invested everything I earned on my prior transaction. And almost 11 wow. years later, we are recording that podcast.
How did you connect it initially with the folks at Distal Motion? How did that happen?
Through a common friend. My board member at the time was also, Reto Hartmann at the time, was also coaching the founder team at Distal Motion. And essentially, I called Reto and said, "Hey, what are the hot young startups that you see? Anything interesting?" And he told me you should look at the Distal Motion team, and that's how I met them. And then it was within 5 minutes, it was clear that I was going to do it.
What was that conviction for you to want to go all in and invest all the money, you know, and go at it, you know, with it?
I that's the beauty of entrepreneurship in a privileged region like Switzerland, where what can you lose? You can only win. If you lose, worst case, you just get a job somewhere. You don't lose social security. You don't lose access to education. You don't lose your apartment. You don't lose anything. You just lose maybe a bit of money, but money can come back. So why not give it a try? Because the opportunity is so humongous. The learning opportunity, the economic opportunity, but also just from a personal development perspective, there's no better way to evolve than being exposed to challenges and overcoming them. And building a company is a massive sequence of challenges. And that really makes it very exciting.
So Distal Motion, for the people that are listening, what ended up Distal Motion today? How do you guys make money?
So with Distal Motion, what we do is we solve the access issue that robotic surgery has, soft tissue robotic surgery has. So we look at procedures done in general surgery, urology and gynecology. So everything in the abdominal and pelvic area fundamentally you have two ways of performing the procedure. You can either do open surgery with the scalpel, opening up the patient and going in with your hands, which is pretty invasive, or you can do a couple of tiny incisions and operate minimally invasively. And whenever you can perform a procedure minimally invasively, patients, they recover faster, they have less scars, less pain, less blood loss, less infections. It's just overall better for the patients to be treated minimally invasively. Now, the thing is, performing minimally invasive procedures is hard to learn, particularly when it comes to suturing, dissection, and working in confined spaces. And robotics really is all about simplifying those complex parts of minimally invasive surgery. And that is what we do with Dexter, our surgical robotic platform. And we do it in a way that not only high complexity inpatient procedures get access to robotics, which today is about 20% of the market, but the other 80% of the market, which are medium to low complexity procedures in rather the outpatient setting, also can access the benefits of robotics and hence been treated with high quality, minimally invasive care. And that really is why we exist, to open up that outpatient medium to low complexity procedure segment. And today we are, from a stage perspective, we've been in a pre-launch in Europe for a few years, where we really refined the product, refined our understanding of the procedures, the training, the clinical development products. And since last October, we have US regulatory approval in inguinal hernia, which is a 1 million procedures per year segment, already pretty massive. And we are starting to sell now in the US. And so our big focus now is the commercial launch and execution, predominantly in the US, to really get into that segment and start to lead in that segment.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
In this case, how did you come across to the idea of or the realization that you needed the right people at every stage of the company?
Yeah, so something that is a little bit unconventional at the way we built this Slowmotion is that when I joined, I met an incredibly talented team of inventors at the time that came, particularly the main founder, Ricardo, came out of his PhD at EPFL, incredibly brilliant mind with a certain view on the technology. And what we realized in 2016 is that we needed to make the company, the technology evolve into areas that into solutions that are no longer based on the initial idea. And at that time, we then had a discussion together, Ricardo and I, and we then decided to set a split path and we did a secondary buyout of Ricardo. Ricardo is very happy with that transaction. We are very happy with the transaction. And that really was already the first time in the story of, in the journey of Slowmotion, where we adapted the team to make sure we have the right people for the right stage. Then from I was the CEO until 23, until autumn 23. And at that point, we then decided, as we were starting to move from the product development, regulatory, innovation dominated phase into the commercially dominated phase of the Slowmotion, to also make sure that we have the right leadership in place. And that's why we hired Greg Roach as our CEO, who then joined in November 23. And I moved into the chief operating officer role, where I'm in charge of what we call solution delivery. So the entire innovation engine at the Slowmotion. And he is predominantly doing the commercial and the financing part, and always CEO role of the business. And it was also very clear to us that given how the market functions in our industry, the single biggest market for medical devices is the US. The region where you get most of the financing also for this Slowmotion is the US, and the region, the country where you have the vast majority of the strategics with whom you could then potentially partner. And last but not least, the only place where you have a really, really good stock market with NASDAQ is the US. And so it was very clear for us that while we are very good here in innovation, in innovating in Switzerland and in Europe, we needed to have finance, commercial, and strategic partnerships done in the US. And to succeed in the US, we wanted to have a CEO that is based, an American based in the US, with the very strong track record in that field, to be the complementary person to the existing team. And we were very fortunate in having found Greg to really complement the team and since then really create a tremendous amount of value with his playing his strength while we continue to do our thing.
So talking about people here, let's talk about the capital side of things, right? So you obviously coming in on board, making the investment, you also brought the investors that you also had from your previous experiences. How has been the journey to of raising money for this company? Because, I mean, now you guys have over 200 employees, you know, perhaps a different size of an operation that you were encountering before, you know, different type of capital required as well. So how much money have you guys raised to date, and what has been the journey of raising that money as well?
Yeah, by now we have raised clearly north of $250 million, which is already quite a substantial amount of money. Still way less than other challengers in robotics, but a lot of money nevertheless. Initially, it all started with private money, business angels, private investors, and a small corporate venture fund who were the lead investors of Series A before I joined. And we have about $40 million in private money. We have about $25 million of a strategic who joined kind of in a second wave. And since then, the money is predominantly private equity investment from predominantly led by Revival Healthcare Capital, a very reputable and strong private equity venture fund out of Austin, Texas. And doing that journey, going through that journey was pretty exhausting, very, very hard, particularly at the beginning when we didn't have any credibility. We were going into a market with a competitor that has already at the time had a market cap of close to $100 billion, several billions in revenue. We were really, 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 really small compared to them. A lot of companies that have tried to go into robotics with a lot of means and a lot of great names and a lot of reputable people around who didn't really manage to go in. We were kind of the underdog with a way simpler approach to robotics, a way more pragmatic approach, a way more Swiss approach to robotics. And for a very long time, we had a hard time convincing not so much the physicians, but the investors that we had a winning hand. And we ran out of money multiple times. We even at one point, we couldn't pay salaries for a month of 60 people. Nobody left though, because everybody believed in the mission. But it was a very, very challenging phase, particularly between 2018 and 2021, when then Revival joined us. And with them, we gained an enormous amount of credibility. Now, obviously, having treated more than 1,600 patients, having revenue in Europe as well as the US, brings us to a way different level. Yeah, but also now, obviously, the burn rate has increased massively. So even now, it's not a walk in the park to raise the capital because it's just burning so much money.
Now, you were alluding to it of having, you know, all these employees, you know, sticking around, even though, you know, you're not able to perhaps, you know, like compensate them, you know, in the way that that it was expected. So obviously, there is a vision, a really strong vision, a sense of, like you were saying, mission, you know, and direction, clear sense of direction of where you're heading and the future that you're living into. So in that regard, if you were to go to sleep tonight, Michael, and you wake up in a world where the vision of distal motion is fully realized, what does that world look like?
For us, really, distal motion is a success once we have really been able to gain substantial market share in these procedures, where we know that we have hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of patients over time that have been able to get good minimally invasive procedures, good minimally invasive treatment, thanks to the tools that we developed. And then we will be really even more proud than we are today. Even today, we can walk through cities and numerous cities in Europe, but also now in the US, and potentially meet people in the street without ever knowing their names, without ever knowing who they are, but people who got treated by tools and products that we developed and that have had good outcomes, good experience. And that is just extremely purpose giving for all of us, because that means that all the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into building distal motion, into making Dexter what Dexter is, that this really then really pays off. And it's a long journey. Distal motion started in 2012, and now it's 13 years later. It's a long, it requires a lot of perseverance. But when you then see that at the end, this starts to translate into results, and I think that's the most rewarding one.
So, I mean, now obviously, you know, three companies in, you know, you've been able to experience quite a bit. So if I was to bring you back in time, let's say I put you into a time machine And I bring you back to that moment where you were a 21-year-old kid, you know, still, you know, doing the studies. And let's say you had the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self and giving your younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
The thing is, you need to have a certain amount of ignorance and a lot of perseverance to start a business. So knowing all it takes before you start, had we known how much it takes to how much money it takes to build this whole motion, would have been probably a bit more challenging to start. I think it would be more probably around early on, also spending, for me personally, spending time on some of the soft skills, negotiation, conflict management, leadership, those types of functions that I had to learn on the job, where I think it would have been maybe good if I had the opportunity to learn that earlier. But that's also one of the reasons why I did choose the job that I run, because I wanted to learn these skills. I think that would have been insightful. I also realized over time that I most likely have an attention deficit syndrome, and I think I should have, in hindsight probably, and that's now a very personal last statement here, probably try to address that and understand that this exists way earlier in my life. I think I could have had a little bit more focus and productivity for myself. But these are more personal notes, because the reality of building a business, they are what they are. And you can only, in looking back, it's always easy to say, well, I could have found the solution earlier had I thought about it properly. But well, it just, now time has passed. And I don't think there are super generic recipes. I've been very fortunate that I've always been surrounded by people who have been very supportive, from a personal life perspective, but also work-life perspective. And I think today it would be more about trying to find a few or find a few of the youngsters and try to help them on their journey. And also, I think last but not least, not every project is a success. And I think what I found the hardest is to accept admitting that a project might not be the right one to invest time on. And I see a lot of projects where people, really good people, are very much in love with their baby, even though it's pretty clear that it's not going to work out. And then it would be really, really important to find peace of mind and the surrounding, a network of people who say, hey, it's fine, you can let it go, use your talent and your limited time you have to do something else, because there are a lot of good ideas out there. Not everything translates into a success, and then it's important to be able to let go and to use the time for something else.
I love it. So, Michael, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest one. I'd love that. Yeah. Otherwise, my email address is good as well. It's michael.friedrich, so my first name dot last name at thistlemotion.com.
Easy enough. Well, Michael, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today with Aris. It has been an absolute honor to have you.
Same. Thank you very much, Alejandro. Have a great afternoon.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.